Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Continuing with the talks from volume 3 of the Ajahn Sumedho anthology, and these talks come from the book The Way It Is, and they come from the 1988 winter retreat here at Amravati. This is chapter 14, called Only One Breath. Venerable Subhuto told me that he had never developed anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath. So I said, can you be mindful of one inhalation? And he said, oh yes. And of one exhalation? And he said, yes. And I said, got it. There's nothing more to it than that. However, one tends to expect to develop some special kind of ability to go into some special state. And because we don't do that, we think we can't do anapanasati. But the way of the spiritual life is through renunciation, relinquishment, letting go, not through attaining or acquiring. Even the jhanas, the states of meditative absorption, are relinquishments rather than attainments. If we relinquish more and more, letting go more and more, then jhanic states are natural. Without going any further, that's a very significant point in the teaching, and a very, often repeated theme, both in Lumpo Sumedho's teachings, also Lumpo Cha would emphasize that one of the things that obstructs spiritual development is the gaining mind, trying to get something to attain, to acquire, to achieve. So it doesn't mean to say not expending effort, not making effort, but rather looking at the mind that wants to get, wants to become, wants to achieve and acquire. And so this comment that Lumpur makes here, that even the jhanas are relinquishments rather than attainments, that's, I think, a very significant and helpful comment. One of the teachings that I find is very helpful in this respect is a sutta in the Book of the Tens in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, sutta number 2, Book of the Tens, and it's often quoted. It's a well-known sutta, and it's usually translated as liberation is a natural process. And the layout of the sutta is that it starts off with sila, actually, interestingly enough. It says, if you live according to the sila, if you have a life that's guided by the moral precepts, then there's no need to wish, may I be free of remorse, may I not have any remorse or regrets. Because for one who lives according to the sila, according to a moral discipline, it's natural to be free of remorse. You haven't done anything to regret, so there's the heart is free of regret and remorse. It's a very simple relationship. Then the sutta goes on to say, one whose heart is free of remorse, there's no need for them to think, may joy, may pamoja, or delight arise in me, because it's natural for one whose heart is free of remorse for there to be joy, for there to be delight, pamoja. And one who experiences delight, then there's no need for them to wish, may I experience rapture and piti, because it's natural for one who experiences delight, for rapture, for joy and rapture to arise within them. And then for one who has experienced pamoja and piti, delight and joy, there's no need for them to wish, may my body be relaxed, may there be tranquility, relaxation in the body, because it's natural. And in the sutta, dhammata is the word that's used as in the teaching, that's translated as natural dhammata. It's in accordance with dhamma. It's of the nature. It's in accordance with nature. It's dhammata, which the Pali word, the Thai word, tamada, comes from. The Pali is dhammata. The Thai is tamada. They have the same meaning. It's natural, ordinary, in accordance with reality, with nature. And so then it goes on to say that when your body is relaxed, when there's tranquility in the body and there's a sensation of ease, of being settled, then there's no need to wish, may I feel content, may there be sukha or happiness or contentment, because one who feels delight and whose body is relaxed, it's natural for contentment to arise, for happiness, for that sense of well-being to arise within them. And then he goes on to say, most significantly with respect to this, one who experiences contentment, a sukha of that nature, there's no need for them to think, may my mind be concentrated, because it's natural for one who is content, whose body is at ease and so forth, for them to be able to concentrate the mind. And then he goes on to say, one whose mind is concentrated, they don't need to think, may knowledge and vision of the way things are, may insight arise within me, because it's natural for one whose mind is concentrated for knowledge and vision of the way things are to arise. So that's why it's called, it's known as liberation is a natural process, that it's an unfolding, a progression of qualities that follow one naturally along from another. And it's not based on me trying to get anything or me trying to acquire, but as Longpo points out, it's based on a quality of letting go, primarily beginning in this respect with skillful behavior, but it's free from any sense of I want to get, but rather that with the appropriate ingredients there, and I would say that process is necessarily guided by mindfulness and wisdom. That's what helps to keep it on track. Then there's a natural unfolding that, as Lumpur says, if we relinquish more and more, letting go more and more, then the jhanic states are natural. Also, part of what is let go of is what we call the five hindrances. So the urges towards sense desire, karma chanda, if you know, there's a letting go of that. And then ill will, vyapada is let go of. And then dullness, drowsiness, dinamita, and restlessness, udaccha, kukuccha. And then finally, vichikicca, doubt. So those are also things that are let go of. But when the five hindrances have been let go of, when those tendencies towards dullness or agitation or aversion and sense desire and so forth, then the mind is not caught up in doubt. When the five hindrances fall away, then it's natural for the attention to focus comfortably in the present. So I feel this is a very, very skillful way of relating to jhana and concentration, and that just taking that principle of it's not about attaining or acquiring, it's about relinquishing, just putting that in place is a really helpful guideline, particularly if you're, say, as we are now, having another winter retreat here at Amravati, more than 30 years after this this talk was given. These teachings still apply as ever, and that particularly in the solo retreat time, where we have a lot of opportunity, hours and hours every day, to focus on formal practice. That just that principle, if it's about relinquishment rather than attaining or acquiring, then out of sincerity, we want to make the best use of the time that we have, but to make the best use of the time for the purpose of relinquishing, letting go, rather than acquiring and becoming and attaining, then I would say that sets things up. It puts the ingredients together in the best possible way, so that the time can be used most profitably, most beneficially. So to continue, the attitude is most important. To practice anapanasati, one brings the attention onto one inhalation, being mindful from the beginning to the end. One inhalation, that's it. And then the same goes for the exhalation. That's the perfect attainment of anapanasati. The awareness of just that much is the result of concentration of the mind through sustained attention to the breath, from the beginning to the end of the inhalation, from the beginning to the end of the exhalation. The attitude is always one of letting go, not attaching to any ideas or feelings that arise, so that you're always fresh with the next inhalation, the next exhalation, completely as it is. You're not carrying over anything, so it's a way of relinquishment, of letting go, rather than of attaining and achieving. The danger in meditation practice is the habit of grasping at things, grasping at states, so that the concept that's most useful is the concept of letting go, rather than of attaining and achieving. Maybe yesterday you had a really super meditation. Absolutely fantastic, just what you've always dreamed of. And then today, you try to get the same wonderful experience as yesterday, but you get more restless and more agitated than ever before. Why is that? Why can't we get what we want? It's because we're trying to attain something that we remember, rather than really working with the way things happen to be now. So the correct way is one of mindfulness, of looking at the way it is now, rather than remembering yesterday and trying to get to that state again. The first year I meditated, I didn't have a teacher. I was in this little hut, this kuti in Nong Khai, for about 10 months, and I had all kinds of blazing insights. Being alone for 10 months, not having to talk, not having to go anywhere, everything calmed down after several months, and then I thought I was a fully enlightened person, an arahant. I was sure of it. I found out later that I wasn't. I remember we went through a famine in Nong Khai that year, and we didn't get very much to eat. I had malnutrition, so I thought, maybe malnutrition's the answer. If I just starve myself. I remember being so weak with malnutrition at Nong Khai that my earlobes started cracking open. When I'd fall asleep, I'd have to pry my eyelids open. They'd be stuck shut with the stuff that comes out of your eyelids when you're not feeling very well. Then one day a Canadian monk brought me 3 cans of tinned milk. In Asia, there's tinned sweetened milk, and it's delicious. Sweetened condensed milk is a product of high value, major currency in the forest monasteries. I don't know if that's changed now, but sweetened condensed milk, Mali milk, I think it was called, the most common brand, serious commodity in forest monastery life back in the day. 3 cans of tinned milk. In Asia, there's tinned sweetened milk, and it's delicious. He also brought me some instant coffee and a flask of hot water. So I made a cup of this, put in a bit of coffee, poured in some of this milk, poured hot water, and started drinking it. And I went crazy. It was so utterly delicious. The first time I'd had anything sweet in weeks, or anything stimulating. And being malnourished and in a very dull, tired, apathetic state, this was like high-octane petrol. Woomph! I gulped it down immediately. I couldn't stop myself. And I managed to consume all 3 tins of milk, and a good proportion of that coffee as well. And my mind actually went flying into outer space. Or it seemed like it, and I thought, maybe that's the secret. If I can just get someone to buy me some tinned milk. When I went to Wabapong the following year, I kept thinking, oh, I had all those wonderful experiences in Nong Khai. I had all those wonderful kinds of beautiful visions, all those fantastic floating experiences and blazing insights, and it seemed I understood everything. I even thought I was an arahant. That first year at Wabapong, I didn't have much of anything. I just kept trying to do all the things I'd done in Nong Khai to get those results. But after a while, even strong cups of coffee didn't work anymore. I didn't seem to get those exhilarations, those fantastic highs and blazing insights that I had in the first year. So, after the first rains retreat at Wabapong, I thought, this is not the place for me. I think I'll go and try to repeat what happened in Nong Khai. And I left Ajahn Chah and went to live on Phupek Mountain in Sokhonnakhorn province. That's a couple of hundred miles, 200 or 300 miles north of Wabapong in Ubon, is down in the southern part of northeast Thailand, and Sokhonnakhorn's about halfway up the bulge of the northeast provinces. There, at last, I was in an idyllic spot. However, for alms round, he had to leave before dawn and go down the mountain, which was quite a climb, and wait for the villagers to come. They'd bring you food, and then you had to climb all the way back up and eat this food before 12 noon. That was quite a problem. I was with one other monk, a Thai monk, and I thought, he's really very good. And I was impressed with him. But when we were on this mountain, he wanted me to teach him English. So I was really angry with him and wanted to murder him. It was an area of northeast Thailand where there were lots of terrorists and communists. Sometime, this was in the, say, 1967, 68, so still in the, well in the thick of the Vietnam War. So sometimes helicopters flew overhead, checking us out. Once they came and took me down to the provincial town, wondering whether I was a communist spy. Then I became violently ill, so ill that they had to carry me down the mountain. I was stuck in a wretched place by a reservoir under a tin roof in the hot season, with insects buzzing in and out of my ears and orifices, and horrible food. I nearly died, come to think of it. I almost didn't make it. But it was during that time in that tin-roofed lean-to that a real change took place. I was really despairing, sick and weak and totally depressed, and my mind would fall into hellish realms with a terrible heat and discomfort. I felt I was being cooked. It was like torture. Then a change came. Suddenly, I just stopped my mind. I refused to get caught in that negativity, and I started to practice Anapanasati. I used the breath to concentrate my mind, and things changed very quickly. After that, I recovered my health, and it was time to enter the next rains retreat, so I went back. I promised Ajahn Chah I'd go back to Wat Bapong for the rains retreat, and my robes were all tattered and torn and patched. I looked terrible. When Ajahn Chah saw me, he just burst out laughing, and I was so glad to get back after all that. I had been trying to practice, and what I had wanted were the memories of those insights. I'd forgotten what the insights really were. I was so attached to the idea of working in some kind of ascetic way, like I did in the first year when asceticism really worked. At that time, being malnourished and being alone had seemed to provide me with insight, so that for the next few years, I kept trying to create those conditions where I'd be able to have those fantastic insights. But the following 2 or 3 years seemed to be years of just getting by. Nothing much seemed to happen. I was 6 months on that mountain before I returned to Wat Bapong, deciding just to stay on and to follow the insights that I had. One of the insights of the first year was that I should find a teacher, that I should learn how to live under a discipline imposed on me by that teacher. So I did that. I realized Ajahn Chah was a good teacher and had a good standard of monastic discipline, so I stayed with him. And those insights that I had were right, but I'd become attached to the memory of them. So there's a lot there in that account, but I thought I'd read that all through in one chunk, just to give us the flavor of that time. And so it's also interesting, Lumpur Sumedho as a young monk, and bearing in mind, he didn't really have any teachers or mentors. He was kind of having to figure it out on his own, because even living with Ajahn Chah, he didn't speak any Thai. And so he couldn't really get much close instruction from Ajahn Chah. There was one other monk there, Prat Somai, who spoke some English, but he wasn't around all the time. So in those early years, the young Lumpur Sumedho had to figure it out on his own. I think we forget how spoiled we are, having lots of experienced people who have done a lot of Dhamma practice for many, many years, who can speak in a language we understand. But Lumpur Sumedho didn't really have that. He had the monastery life. He had a couple of books, say the Word of the Buddha by Venerable Nyanatiloka. He had the Charles Luke Chan and Zen training books, but there wasn't really much to guide him other than his own practice and just doing what he could to understand Lumpur Cha. So I think that's one thing to bear in mind. And but also, the experience of that period and recognizing that going back to Wat Bapong, and as he put it, the following 2 or 3 years seemed to be years of just getting by, that he had the intuition, and I would say the great wisdom, to realize just because the blazing insights are not arising, that doesn't mean to say that the practice isn't progressing. And one of the things that Lumpu Cha would emphasize is that it's really important not to be taken in or to think that those sort of vivid insights or having nimittas, having, say, meditation visions or powerful experiences of absorption and such like, he was singularly unimpressed by those, because it was more his concern, what the mind does with those sorts of experience than having those experiences. And so I think that the readiness that Lumpo Sumedho had to just sort of endure the ordinariness of life at Wat Bopong, and to be ready to listen to the mind that's trying to get back, you know, that maybe I should be malnourished again, or maybe I should, with that sense of I want to get back to that wonderful state, that beautiful time that I had before. That part of him was following that, but also in reading this account and his readiness to be at Wat Bopong for a few more years without those kind of fantastic insights, as he described them, that there's this, and also receiving the input from Lumpu Cha, that yes, there is that wish to get back to that, but also there's the encouragement from the teacher to see that those things are not so important. Don't be fascinated by that. And so that there was I would say one of the important things is recognizing that sometimes progress can be happening without it being apparent at the surface level, that we can actually be doing all the work necessary that to develop the practice, to develop the path. But that might not be showing it on a surface level, that the changes can be happening underground or sort of invisible to our eye, and to be looking just for the signals of progress or being affirmed by the teacher or having profound states of meditation, that can sometimes be more of an obstruction or a problem or a difficulty. And during these early years, Jack Kornfield came along about 1969, became a monk in Thailand and was training with Ajahn Chah. When Lumpu Sumedho was up on Phupek Mountain in Sokhondakorn, that's when he first met Jack, when Jack was in the Peace Corps there in northeast Thailand. He met the young Ajahn Sumedho at that time up at Phupek Mountain. And when Jack had become a monk, he stayed with Lumpu Cha for a little while and then went off traveling and practiced with various different ajahns in Thailand and went off to Burma and did various retreats, had spent time with different sayadaws in Burma. And then when he came back to Wat Bopong, as the account goes, both as he described it and as Lumpur Sumedho would describe it, when Jack told Lumpur about the various places he'd been, the practices he'd done, and the kind of insights he'd had, experiences he had with the meditation, Lumpur Cha's comment was, "Well, that's a lot of interesting things for you to let go of, then, isn't it? You know, so that the challenge now is to be able to let go of all of that." So singularly unimpressed by the content of the experiences, one would, you know, as I read his comment, but saying, okay, that's all very well, but what is your mind doing with it now? And that was really, I feel, that the important theme that comes through this account of Lumpu Sumedho, and he's talking how his attachment to the memory of those wonderful experiences, that they were valid, as he says, you know, those insights that I had were right. They were valid. What he saw, what he understood, those were truths. Those were valid insights. It didn't mean that he'd been deluded or that they were wrong or not useful, but the attachment to the memory of them and then getting obsessed with trying to get back to relive those states, that was proving itself to be an obstruction. And so that was, I feel, something that's very helpful for us to learn from, and that I can do the same thing myself. I can look back to various meditation experiences or retreat times and say, well, that was really something special. That was really a valuable time. Well, that was really a powerful insight. But if I'm trying to replicate the conditions or trying to get back to that same, I want to be having that same kind of solitude, or I want to have the exact same conditions, or like Lumpur Sumedho is describing here, trying to be malnourished like he was in Nongkai, or maybe I need to get some of that sweet milk again. Maybe that was the milk and the coffee mixture. That was the magic ingredient that did it. And that's the trick. You have to recognize, yes, there's an appeal. Yes, those insights were valid. Those experiences were important. But here and now, it's this way. And there is the memory of that. And there's the feeling of longing to relive that. That's what's here now. As a memory, as a feeling of longing, that's what's present. And over the years, leading many, many retreats, 10-day retreats and, you know, weekends and week-long retreats and such like, and talking with different retreatants in many, many places around the planet, it's so common to have that experience of people having a powerful insight and important and significant meditation experiences, and then spending years and years trying to get back to that experience, trying to replicate the conditions and trying this, trying that, or well, it was in the morning time, so the morning is my best time, and I can't wait till tomorrow. Then I'll have another opportunity to get that, or you know, who was the cook at that time? That was maybe it was the food that I was eating. That was really good, and so this well-intentioned but agonizing effort to replicate the conditions and not realizing that the very effort to try and relive a memory is something that is obstructing it, because even if you get the conditions to come together that exactly mimic the conditions as they were at that time, the mind that is trying to do it is being influenced by that effort to recreate, so that ironically it's almost doomed in every case. I'm happy to be corrected, but mostly those efforts to relive those experiences don't work out, or at least I've very, very rarely, if ever, heard of anyone saying, yes, well, I put the same conditions together, I sat in the same spot, and it's the same time of the year, and bingo, you know, I got exactly what I was wanting. I don't know of any any occasions where that's actually occurred, and I'd be I would probably respond with the same kind of comment of Lumpur Cha. Well, that's even more for you to let go of then. So it is a dependency that we can create. You become, say, reliant on a particular set of conditions, and then what the mind does is then says, oh, that's when it's good, and that's when the real thing is with that experience or those conditions. Therefore, the rest of life, the other patterns of perception and experience, that's not so real, or that's not so valuable, that's not so true. You know, the Dhamma is not really there in the same way, which is, I would say, quite tragic or a misunderstanding. And that one of the things that Lumpur Cha would emphasize, and Lumpur Sumedha goes on to describe, is that how it's the challenge is to say appreciate the value of those kind of experiences and then let them go, and to use the ordinariness of our life, the everyday perceptions that we have, as the source of contemplation, as the source that of say wise reflection, and where wisdom arises. As Lumpur Cha would say, everything teaches us if we let it. If we are wise, everything will teach us the bright and beautiful, insightful mind states, and the painful, miserable, difficult ones. Sitting in the dentist chair, having your teeth pulled out, can be insightful. Yeah, and the experience of having an injured leg, you know, not being able to sit on the floor, can be insightful. You can think, well, that's an obstruction to my practice. I really want to be able to sit on the floor. No, my bad knee is not beneficial to my practice. Ajahn, excuse me. So, with all due respect to the chair beings that we have, but when one can feel that. But that's, I would say, that's exactly the kind of thing that Lumpur Cha would point to, say, oh, so your knee is your teacher. That's your Ajahn, is your knee. And so that, don't look at it as an obstacle, but look at it as a teacher. And then lo and behold, if the attitude changes, we find that the both the sort of beautiful and exalted experiences and the mundane ones and the painful and difficult ones, they are equally effective as our teachers. And so I feel it's very important to say setting that framework for practice in terms of our attitude, that so valuable to see it in that way. And also, I think with Lumpur Samedho describing here those sort of years of life seeming very ordinary, just as you said, just getting by at Wat Pa Phong, it doesn't represent a kind of switching off or a not caring or a laziness. But I would say that it's it represents a quality of wisdom of like not looking for the tokens of transcendence or the experiences that say, ta-da, you know, well done, Samedho, you're doing a grand job, you know, but rather you're not relying on having those signals, those tokens that say yes, progress is being made, but rather you're ready to appreciate, well, you know, the work is being done, the time is going by, so the work is having its effect, whether that's visible or not, whether that's apparent or not. Rather like, you know, right now, I've got, there's one one daffodil is flowered outside my kuti. It's always the first one every year, the particular daffodil. It's got one daffodil in flower, but the other bulbs are underground. Some of them have produced leaves, and other bulbs, like for the crocus, the crocuses or the hyacinths, they're sort of, yeah, they're there and they're sprouting a little bit, but they're waiting for their time to flower. So the potential is there, the bulb is there in the ground, but the conditions need to come together for the thing to sprout and for a stalk to rise up and a flower to actually blossom, so that the bulb is still underground, and for the tulips and such like that come later in the year, they're all still there, haven't vanished, but it's just not the season for them. It's not the time for them to rise up and blossom. So our practice is a lot like that. If you always want to have signs that yes, you're doing well, yes, you're on the right track, yes, here's a the kind of sign, the manifestation of your progress, ta-da, you know, this is where you're at, to have a kind of device, like what I would call a paramita meter, you know, how well you're doing on the path and how many points you've racked up today. It's like, we might like that, but it's just not the way that things work. And it's far better to just be not reliant on those kind of signals, those sort of manifestations of progress or things going well, but rather just doing the work that's necessary. And when those signs of progress or development rise up, then you can acknowledge that, but we don't have to depend on it. And one of the, even in the Buddha's time, that would often come up as a question or as an issue, people feeling that they were not getting anywhere in the practice, or they were sort of been in the monastery for a year or 5 years or 10 years and don't seem to be getting anywhere, or sometimes after 25 years of practice feeling like, this is hopeless, I'm not getting anywhere, this is a disaster. One of the verses, or there's quite a few of the verses in the Theragata, the verses of the elder monks and nuns, where it talks about the Sangha members practicing for years and years and having no apparent progress. And one particular monk, it's like he's thrown a rope around a branch of a tree and he's got it around his neck, ready to commit suicide. So 25 years and not a finger snap of peace. You know, there's no point carrying on. And he's really despairing. It's in the verse, I forget which number verse of the Theragata, but that's quite a powerful statement. 25 years as a monk and not a finger snap of peace. So those of you who are still below 25 years, it can go on and on before we experience much peace. But then he realizes, as he got the rope around his neck, actually, during that entire time, I've really given my heart to the practice. I've tried to practice the Dhamma and the Vinaya all that time. So, wow, that's really quite a wonderful thing. And and realized arahatship with the rope around his neck. So I don't encourage anyone to get a rope. This is, I realize this is being recorded and put on a website. So the rope is not the essential ingredient, just like the sweetened condensed milk is not the essential ingredient. The mind is the essential ingredient. But just to say that we can feel that no progress is happening. But, you know, that monk didn't realize arahantship just out of the blue. He had actually developed a lot of paramita, but because of the incessant chatter of the mind, that the good work that had been done was not apparent, not visible. And so his perception at the surface level was 25 years of monastic life and not a finger snap of peace. But the work was going on underground. And then in that moment of letting go and, you know, realization, then boom, all of those paramitas ripened. Another image that the Buddha gave, he said it's like a carpenter. If a carpenter has a tool like a saw, when they have a new saw, the handle is quite smooth. It's shaped according to the form that the tool maker has crafted it, and then the carpenter won't be registering, you know, today so much of the handle has been worn away. But rather, they will notice after using it for 5 years or 10 years, oh, look, yeah, my fingerprints are worn into the handle. There's actually the way I hold it, my thumb and my fingers have worn a set of dents into the handle. And so that it's clear that there's changes that have been made consistently, steadily over that time, but you only notice it after some years have gone by. And as the Buddha said, you don't. The carpenter doesn't think, oh, you know, today so much of the handle has been worn away. But after 5 years, 10 years, oh my, look, my goodness, look, there's a deep impressions have been formed. So, before I go on, any questions, thoughts, reflections? Yes, Maureen, can you get the microphone?
So my question has to do with, I totally get this idea that we should, you know, let's say you have an insight or some progress and you shouldn't attach to it as a state that, you know, you're trying to achieve again and again. But there's also the idea that as you are, let's say, doing anapanasati or whatever your meditation practice is.
Can you say that again?
As you're doing anapanasati or whatever meditation practice, that subject that you're using, and you're maybe doing it in a kind of a systematic way, there's, I think the Buddha talks about how, you know, you need to remember what steps you took in order to repeat it, and that you need to review, you know, once you've, let's say, once you finish your meditation, you go back and review how you did, you know, how you got to where you got during that meditation, let's say. Or specifically, I'm thinking of a short sutta that Rose read at our Dhamma tea the other day, where the Buddha talks about, and I don't know what sutta it is, we'd have to look it up. The Buddha talks about a cow who doesn't explore her own pasture, but keeps trying to get to the next pasture before she's fully explored the pasture she's in, and how she's going to lose track of the pasture she's in and not going to be able to make her way back because she didn't fully understand everything in that pasture before she tried to move on. And so I wonder if you could speak to that side of things. You know, it's obviously not meant for you to attach to whatever progress you made, but you are supposed to kind of know what steps you're taking and what path you have forged already, and also review it. You could speak to that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, the teachings talk about developing the path, magga, and being a magga bhavaka, one who develops the path. So, like, if you want to walk from here to the Bridgewater Monument in Ashridge, or to Ivinghoe Beacon or Dagnall Village, and you make a walk one day and you go, this is a really nice place. There's a nice little village, a nice little sort of quiet churchyard I can sit in, and I want to remember how I got here. So, you know, you walk back along the same path, so you take note of particular landmarks. Okay, I took a left. I took a left at this signpost for the footpath, right? Okay, remember that. So just as a physical path going to, you know, to Ivinghoe Beacon or to Dagnall Village or wherever you walk to, then it's exactly the same way. But you can make that walk rather than being obsessed with where you've got to get to or that you've achieved something by getting there. You can then, you've memorized the way to get to Ivinghoe Beacon. And so then when you set out for another walk, then you know where to go. You're making the effort to carry out the walk. You're not obsessing on, I've got to get to Ivinghoe. But rather, as you're walking, you're with each footstep, you're heading in that direction, you're following the signs, but the mind is free of the bhava tanha, the desire to become, and that sense of agitation, me getting somewhere. You can enjoy the walk. And as the body is walking, then you're getting to the place where you want to go to. So in a way, that's about the skillful attitude towards directionality. So, I mean, we talk about the Eightfold Path. A path is heading in a particular direction. Like, it's not a sort of the Eightfold sort of random field. It's the Eightfold Path. It's got there's a direction, there's a goal. You know, and the ending of dukkha is that's Ivinghoe. That's the beacon. You know, that you do have spiritual teachings that say things like, you know, truth is a pathless land and such like, that have their own validity on an ultimate level. But on the practical sort of conditioned level, it's useful to have a path and a direction. So that's the Four Noble Truths, and including the Eightfold Path. They are, addressing the how to work with the conditions of our life, our mind, our body, and apply the capacities that we have as a human being to go in a direction, psychologically, spiritually, that lead to the end of suffering. So with developing anapanasati or all the different aspects of the spiritual path, then it's very helpful to be aware of the, you know, those landmarks, so you can remember what the path is, you can remember how you got there, you can follow those steps, so it becomes well-trodden. But the essential thing is the attitude towards it, and like what Lumpur Samedo is saying, it's that the gaining mind, the wanting to achieve or to attain, like, I want to achieve, I want to accomplish getting to Ivinghoe Beacon, or I want to get to the church in Dagnall Village so I can sit in the churchyard. It's like, you're not relating to it as an attainment or as some kind of acquisition, but just rather a skillful direction that leads to a beneficial end. All of that can be free of self-view, free of conceit, and free of that bhava tanha. So, the Buddha's teaching is a path of effort. It's a path. And a path is only useful if a being makes effort to travel along that path. Otherwise, it's not a path. It's just a line on the ground or a psychological line. You know, the main issue I feel is how effort can be applied that's in accordance with Dhamma, rather than effort being based on self-view and conceit and goal fixatedness, as it were, you know, that kind of. So there's a few days ago there was a question about chanda and tanha, the different kinds of desire. So that's, in a way, the key to this whole area, is distinguishing these different kinds of desiring, so that you can have the wish to get to Ivanhoe Beacon. It's completely free of anything that's unwholesome or obstructive or unskillful, and you can make the effort to walk there. And then, having arrived there, you can enjoy and be benefited by the results of having arrived there, and that whole journey can be something that is free of dukkha and free of creating the causes of dukkha, so that effort can be made, direction can be taken, as long as the motivating force is chanda, and that is free of ignorance and free of self-view and such like. So that's the key thing. It's often a mistake that people make, that any kind of giving any kind of direction or is somehow antithetical to the practice. But that's not the case. You know, otherwise, why would the Buddha use the imagery of a path right there in the Four Noble Truths? It's like, this is the path leading to the path leading to the ending of. It's like there's a path, and then there needs to be an agent who's traveling along that path. So from the level of conventional truth, that's the structure that we use. And as I was saying, sort of dutiyampi, the key thing is learning how effort can be made, direction can be given, free of desire, free of tanha, free of the causes, the things that cause dukkha. So the effort is made in accordance with Dhamma. So essentially, the development of right effort, sama vayamo, and that is, if it was not possible to make effort free of craving, or free of self-view and conceit, then you couldn't have effort as an aspect of the Eightfold Path. You know, every kind of effort, every kind of doing, every kind of every aspect of decision-making or directionality would necessarily produce dukkha, but it's right there as part of the Eightfold Path. A lot of the aspects of the path involve decision-making, you know. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. It's all like, do this, don't do that. There's choices being encouraged. So it's one of those aspects of the Buddha's teaching that I feel is really central. To get a feeling of, like, how to walk without going anywhere. You have a direction, but it's not me trying to get there. But you're able to walk and enjoy the walk. How to practice, make effort, give a direction to, say, concentration or insight, enjoying the work, but without trying to get somewhere. And that as we practice, getting a feel for how that functions, that's so helpful, so beneficial and liberating. Gaspar, are you approving or asking to speak?
Both.
So there's a microphone there if you wish.
Well, first, allow me to express my appreciation for these lively and colorful transmissions of the text. I've been enjoying them very much. And just to reflect on one thing, regarding the experience of Lungpur Sumedho and sort of being deprived of a teacher and then sort of having to rely on himself for his spiritual development. I have a sense that this sort of worked, although I haven't sort of have a personal contact with Lungpur Sumedho, but I have a sense that this might have been beneficial in the sense that had worked to an advantage, and to sort of connect that with the idea of commoditization in today's commoditizing. Yeah, in terms of the accessibility to teachers that we have today, with the proliferation of the internet and many media that are present today, I see dangers in terms of sort of attaching mistaking the teacher for the teaching. And so I was wondering whether you have some guidance to share with this in this respect. Thank you.
There is a what they call a plethora, a vast number of teachers around, the opportunities to listen to spiritual teachings of a great variety, and you know, many of great repute and great value. I think the one of the conversations I was having today with some of the monastic community was one of the aspects of a teacher and the teaching process, and one thing I really have greatly appreciated from the style of Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Someto is that even though we would talk of them as the teacher, they were both really encourage the understanding that they're not really the teacher. You yourself are the teacher. That someone who's sitting in a chair like this with a microphone and so on, that your job is to help people to teach themselves. So if I think I'm the source of knowledge and that it's up to me to give it to you and you haven't got it, then that's what I would say is an incorrect or unhelpful dynamic, obstructive ultimately, but rather to see that the job of a person in the role of teacher is to help people to teach themselves and to say that you already are everything that is valuable and real. That reality is part of who you are, what you are already. And so the role of the teacher is to help someone to teach themselves and to uncover that reality, to realize, awaken to the Dhamma within themselves. So that, and I feel that that's something that both Lumpo Cha and Lumpo Someto have done very, very well over the years. And it encourages a quality of self-reliance also in the student and a lack of dependency on the teacher, so the teacher can be a catalyst, like an agent of change. They can help by them being around and offering guidance. They can help that, but Lumpo Cha would often say, "Don't look at me, look at yourself." You know, well, my job is to tell you, "Don't look at me, look at yourself." You know, so that I think one of the difficulties of having that plethora, that vast range of teachings, is that you can endlessly be looking for inspiration, and that you can be enthusiastic about one teacher or one form of expression, and then when you hit the sort of valley of despair or the sort of bit bored, or I heard that before, it's just the same talk, but it's just kind of rearranged it a bit, and so you find another source of inspiration. So going from one springtime to another, one inhalation to another, just one sort of uplifting, wow, listen to that, that's really amazing, and just feeling, being excited, being interested is somehow equal to genuinely being benefited, or genuinely making those changes within your own citta, within your own heart and mind, that are really going to be beneficial. So relying on inspiration. So I feel that's a bit of a downside of having such a vast array of teachings and teachers, is that you can really keep going for a long, long time, just hopping from one inspiration to another and never really making the changes within yourself that are needed. And I think in Western culture, things are not quite so idealistic or sort of inspiration oriented as they were in the 70s and 80s back then. I think there's maybe a mixture of cynicism and maturity. There's a bit more of that around nowadays, but it's very possible just to be going from one sort of, wow, that's interesting, let me share this with you, and hopping from one inspired moment, one inspired teaching to another, and that in that avoiding the difficult areas of our own jitters, the things that we don't really want to see about ourselves, what is it in here that's bored, what in here is now feeling dissatisfied. What do I do with that bored, dissatisfied, meh feeling? If you never face that, you never work with that, then you never get beyond it. You just go to the next springtime, next inhalation, the next so dazzling, promising, insightful teacher. And when I lived in California, I was around there for 15, 20 years, that was such a common issue. Because there was a huge number of spiritual teachers and opportunities in that area. The Bay Area directory of spiritual teachers and centers was literally like a phone book. It was kind of amazing variety of opportunities. But people would just often be so sort of exhausted with inhaling all the time, like one inspiration after another. So one of the things that I felt it kind of came out of my living there was that rather than feeling we at Abhayagiri Monastery and our tradition, our practice had to keep inspiring people, but rather just to help people to not be dependent on that inspiration, or not to always be looking for the perfect teacher or the perfect place or the perfect practice, or being dazzled by the next new thing or the next new satguru, you know, on the block. But to encourage that sense of, you know, learning from your trip to Costco, you know, learning from your family, your visit to spend Thanksgiving with your family, you know, learn from sitting in the queue on the Bay Bridge waiting to go through the toll gate, you know, the utterly ordinary elements of everyday life in that area, rather than looking for happiness, satisfaction, spiritual fulfillment for the next sort of promising spiritual sort of the presenter of spiritual teachings. Okay, maybe just have this last little paragraph here. Actually, this is quite a long talk, so I'll just go to this convenient end point here. People get very attached to all these special things like meditation retreats and courses where everything is under control, everything is organized, and there is total silence. Even though you do have insight then, reflection is not always there, because one assumes that to have those insights, you need those conditions. Actually, insight is more and more a matter of living insightfully. It's not just that you have insight sometimes, but that more and more, as you reflect on Dhamma, everything is insightful. You see insightfully into life as it's happening to you. As soon as you think you have to have some special conditions for insight, but are not aware of that thought, you'll create all sorts of complexities around your practice. So, I developed letting go, not concerning myself with attaining or achieving anything. I decided to make little achievements possible by learning to be a little more patient, a little more humble, and a little more generous. I decided to develop in this way rather than going out of my way to control and manipulate the environment with the intention of setting myself up in the hope of getting high. It became apparent through reflection that attachment to the insights was the problem. The insights were valid insights, but the problem was attachment to the memory of them. Then the insight came to let go of all insights, not to attach to them, just to keep letting go of all the insights one may have, because otherwise they become memories. And memories are conditions of the mind, and if you attach to them, they can only take you to despair. So once again, that's what underscores some of the points that I was making and that I was just talking about. If you reflect on Dhamma, everything is insightful. Your feelings of disappointment, your feelings of inspiration and excitement, the feelings of utter ordinariness, that's something that is so mundane it doesn't really even have a word for it. It's just so ordinary there isn't even a word for its ordinariness. Just the completely unremarkable. To keep bringing attention, because the Dhamma is here and now. The field of sense perception in terms of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, in terms of mood, whether it's shocking or sad or cramped or expansive or agitated or dull or whatever it might be, that there's the perspective that how could the Dhamma not be here? The Dhamma is here and now. It's akaliko. It's timeless. How can it not be here? This loud noise might be dominating, or this painful feeling in the body, or this dull mood, this kind of depressive mood. It can be present, but I feel it's most helpful to recognize that. Everything will teach us if we let it. And what it teaches us is that this is the pattern of experience in this moment. This cannot not be impermanent. This has to be impermanent. It can't be an absolute reality. Even though it might feel like this is going to be here forever, this is going to be here forever feeling. And I've certainly had that. I've had experiences where the mind was in a really kind of dark, heavy, depressed state, and it really did feel like, how could this ever not be here? This is absolutely real. That this can't change. This is the reality. And then 3 weeks later, oh right. Where did that go? That was going to be here forever. And maybe it's three months or 3 years. But I feel that. Everything, that principle, that everything will teach us if we let it. And the main message of this is, as Lumpo Sumedho puts it here, insight is more a matter of living insightfully. So we tend to talk about insight as a sort of, oh, wow, moments of clarity, particularly in meditation or sort of special experiences. But I think that that's so helpful in terms of spiritual advice. That living insightfully, so that that inquiring mind, that's the quality of wise reflection, that says, "Yeah, this really feels like it's an absolute, permanent condition. That's what this feels like," and that recognizing, "Okay, this is what the feeling is in this moment. It feels this way. I am this way. I've always been like this. I always will be like this." That's what the mind is saying. That's what this feeling is. Oh, so that application of wise reflection, using that as a framework, as a kind of medium for holding how the mind holds the experience of the present. That's what genuinely liberates, irrespective of what the content of the perceptual field is, in terms of mood or sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or of thinking. That reflective attitude, that's the quality that liberates. And so I heartily encourage that. It's now 3 minutes past seven, so I think I'll leave it there for today and offer these thoughts for consideration for everyone.